Hey there, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we are going to continue in our mythology series with the season 3 episode Nisei. Mm-hmm. And we will be back with 731 next time because these are really, really dense, heavy episodes.
Yeah.
Before we dive in, what is your overall feeling on these two episodes?
Like, just, I love them.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, not to like jump right in there. I love them. No, I really, really like these ones, actually.
Yeah.
I've tended in the past to be more of a 731 fan than a Nisei fan, and we'll probably get into why I've kind of felt that way. But I actually appreciate them both a little more after rewatching them this week. But I have a thing for trains, and so there's a lot of trains in this. That helps. And they're just solid episodes for me. They're just, you know, I love anything to do with Scully's abduction, and we get a ton about that.
Oh,
so
yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of Scully. Scully is being kick-ass. Lots about her abduction. There are trains. Mulder looks hot in a leather jacket. I mean, what's not to like? So I love these two.
Yeah, me too. I think these are really cool. I think it's like the first time I feel like, I mean, the mythology starts to get a little wonky. I don't want to say like wonky in terms of like, it's just like, because it's a lot. Like, and I think they're trying to sort of connect dots, and I think they are successfully doing that. But at the same time, it's like, okay, you're connecting them, but you are just kind of adding more dots. And which is, as long as there's a connection, which there is, I don't have a problem with that. But I think the more dots there are, the more difficult it is to sort of formulate that picture in your mind. And I feel like that kind of started here for me. I think overall, as these episodes are entertaining, like insanely entertaining, but a little bit confusing. Do you get
that? A little bit. Yeah. I mean, I never really noticed or cared about that before. I was just kind of like, oh, I like this.
Yeah.
But when I kind of broke it down this week, knowing we were going to talk about it, I got very confused a few times. I have, my notes are just full of question marks. Who's this guy? Why is he here? What are they doing? And some of them started to become clear as I watched the episode, but some I'm not still 100% clear on, but there's a lot happening. It's a complex story, sort of weaving in and out of a couple of different sort of directions. But I think they actually do a good job of writing it and putting it together.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's a lot happening here and a lot of new stuff being thrown our way. There's a lot to absorb.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll be able to break it down a little bit, and I'll hopefully be able to better understand it. And maybe our listeners will too.
You know, it's interesting looking at like the writers and directors are different on both of these. And I was going to look into that, you know, when I got a minute to sit down and actually break this down, because they do feel kind of like two distinct episodes to me. Like it's definitely a two-parter, obviously, but it just like, I don't know, just like kind of the pacing and the tone of each feel slightly different. Like 731, definitely a Rob Bowman episode. Like, I don't know, like it was a lot more actiony, and just by its very nature. I mean, that's not the episode's fault or anything. It's just, that's the way it is. And Nisei is a little bit more of a slow build into.
Yeah.
And that's David Nutter. And, but they both are very, I think, successful in their various ways. I think, Nisei is written by Chris Carter, Howard Gordon, and Frank Spotnitz, and 731 is just Frank Spotnitz.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting...
According to my in-depth reading of Wikipedia today, or was this somewhere else that I got this? I got this somewhere. And according to that information, this was originally meant to be a one-parter written by Frank Spotnitz. And at some point, it became clear... No, we cannot do this in one episode. And I suspect maybe that's where Chris Carter and Howard Gordon got involved and kind of rewrote the first half to turn it into Nisei.
Right.
And they just maybe left the second half more or less alone, which is why Frank Spotnitz still has the single credit for that. That's just kind of speculation on my part. But I guess that's kind of how it unfolded initially. And looking at it now, I can't believe they ever thought they could do that in one episode. I'm guessing it changed quite a bit.
You know, it's funny that you say that because I feel slightly differently. Like, I feel like this could have been one episode because there were so many red herrings and because there it felt like there was a lot of unnecessary shoe leather and you know, things that happened that maybe took longer than needed or information that went nowhere. And I know that's the very nature of the show, but I feel like that, I don't know, I'm not saying they should have done it any differently. I'm just saying that, like, that makes sense to me that you told me that this could have been one episode, just a very, very, very jam-packed one episode, and they sort of spread it out over two, which I think at the end of the day was probably the right decision, but I think
probably
because of that, I feel like they added in maybe some extra stuff that...
I kind of feel like, for me personally, there's like 1.5 episodes here, and they stretched it to two just because I feel, for me personally, like Nisei is a little slow-paced for me. Mm-hmm. They probably could have sped that up, but, you know, they were like setting the table for 7:31, and there's still there's just a ton of stuff, a ton of information in Nisei. It's not an action-packed episode, but there is a lot of information that we learned in that episode that you kind of need for 7:31 to make sense. So I get the way they did it, but some of it stretches a little longer than it absolutely had to, whereas I think 7:31 is a very tight episode in comparison.
Yes. And there's a lot, tighter is the perfect way to say it. Like, we have the Mulder story happening, and then we basically have the Scully story happening of her sort of figuring it out. Whereas Nisei was just like, oh my God, they were both all over the place doing all kinds of random shit.
And they come back together and then they separate and blah, blah, blah.
And there was a lot of, I think, and we'll get into this, but I felt like there was just kind of a lot of confusing sort of doublespeak, like people saying one thing and then you find out something in the next episode or the next scene that kind of, I don't want to say contradicts, but kind of confuses what you just learned. And then you're trying to hold that in your head. And then in the next scene, you hear something else and you're like, but wait, what now? And then
is this the same as what was that?
It was a lot. It was a lot.
My sort of understanding of what we were learning about the mythology changed quite a bit in the course of watching the episodes. Cause I was kind of thinking one thing at the start, but then by the end, I'm like, okay, no, I think that this is actually something else. And I mean, hey, that's good sort of X-Files storytelling. It is a lot of complicated stuff and you're never quite sure what to believe. And this certainly takes that to the hilt.
Absolutely. Okay. So why don't we just jump on in here and break this plot apart? What do you think about that?
Let's do it. Kaboom.
So this to me kind of felt like a different version of Paperclip. It was kind of like Paperclip's telling us what's going on with like these Nazi war criminals and what they're working on, and it's like this is kind of bringing it into a more like an even more worldly, like okay, now we know that we have these Japanese scientists and doctors that are working for the on the same project, but it is interesting because they sort of start to introduce the concept of sort of there's some dissent going on between the countries and who wants what and who wants the information. And that, I feel like this is sort of the first time we're getting that bit of plot, right?
Yeah. This is quite interesting. It is a lot. It's very much sort of picks up where Paperclip left off. And it is very, very similar in terms of the subject that's being discussed, although in a different way. And there's lots of different elements to it. But it is almost like a mirror episode. It's like, Paperclip is, you know, the German side, the Nazi side of things. And this Nisei 7:31 is like sort of what was going on with the Japanese side of things. Similar stories, but slightly different. And definitely different in terms of the connection between the syndicate and the scientists, whether it's with the Germans, with whom they seem to have a very sort of close relationship, or with the Japanese, where their relationship clearly is deteriorating quickly. Mm-hmm. And that kind of adds an interesting element to Nisei 7:31, I think, that, you know, there is this kind of, which makes total sense, you know, when you get different parties and different countries involved in anything, they're going to have slightly different interests, and that's always going to wind up leading to conflict. So I thought it was interesting the way they pursued that.
Yeah, and even like you were saying, it kind of a mirror image of those episodes, even almost visually, like Blessing Way starts out with the burning boxcar, you know? Then here we are at the end of, when we get to it, in the end of 7:31, we have an exploding boxcar and Mulder's being pulled out of it. It's just kind of a cool little parallel.
As I wrote down in my notes at one point, nothing good happens on trains on the X-Files. It's
Nothing
it's,
at
it's
all.
It's a place of all kinds of mischief. So we do see there definitely is like a sort of through thread of the evil of what happens on trains,
right,
of all things.
Right.
But
and
it's
interesting. This definitely won't be the last time either. So
it will not.
Keep your fear of trains rolling. Speaking of fear of trains,
yes.
I love the way that they open this episode. It's just so classic X-Files. Mm-hmm. It's like, we're in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I just love the idea that it's like, it's very eerie that we have like all these just happy children on their bikes and they're waving at the trains. And like, meanwhile, this really like
so
diabolical
great.
Plot is unfolding right under their noses.
So cool. It's so cool. It's so X-Files, that, you know, things that look very on the surface, very normal, very wholesome, very everyday, behind the scenes, very sinister and secret in addition to that. So perfectly sort of like encapsulated in that sort of cold open.
Yeah, it was just, it's a really cool, interesting cold open. Again, an example of one of those things that I'm like, okay, it felt slightly dragged out. Like there were
the actual autopsy part, you mean?
No, just the cold open itself. It just felt like it felt very long, and I don't know.
It's a bit long. They could have tightened it up slightly.
Yeah. Again, I might be making comments like this throughout, and this is just me being nitpicky. But again, to go back to the idea that like, okay, it makes sense that there was enough story here for one episode, but they turned it into two. So anyway, so this train, just to be clear. And bear with me here, Jen. This train starts in Tennessee and ends up in Allentown, correct? That's where the secret train is getting unloaded or something? Is that what's happening here?
I'm trying to remember the actual... I wasn't paying that much attention to the geography, to be honest.
Yeah,
so
I don't know how much it matters, but...
It starts off in Tennessee, and that's where the autopsy happens.
No, I believe the autopsy happens in Allentown because that's
they get to Allen. But does the train actually go to Allentown?
Traveling for like a long time at the very beginning of the episode. But I'm wondering about
maybe it wasn't actually in Allentown. I just did not pick up on that.
The purpose of that. Like, why are we seeing the train travel other than to just sort of like kind of get into people's heads the fear of like, you know, again, we see this again in Fight the Future. Just the idea that these trains are being shipped all over the right, like these trucks, like trucks in EBE that are carrying the ship, and they're going all over the country, and people are none the wiser of what they're carrying.
Right.
And I mean, I like the idea of that, but I do believe that they end up in Allentown because that's where the guy who got the tape was killed.
Yeah, because he's in Allentown and he got that
off the
satellite.
I'm guessing
at 2 a.m. I remember that part.
So
yeah, it makes sense that he was nearby when that was happening. Why they were on the move that way, I don't know. Is it a question of like, you know, it kind of comes down to the question of why did they have this kind of secret railroad system going on? Is it because it's easier to keep things secret when you're on the move all the time? No one, and railroads as a location tend to not be well sort of they're not public spaces, and so people can't really see what's happening there.
Yeah, and later the idea that guy was like, oh, we don't know what's in the car. I mean, I don't know what's in it. It's just there. And I'm just kind of like, really? Does that seem like a really safe procedure to not know what's in the boxcar on your train?
Yeah, seriously, like if you have a derailment, you probably have to know what's in that.
Yeah,
so I don't know how accurate that is.
It was just kind of a strange thing to say that felt kind of like it was sealing up a plot point a little bit. And I was just kind of like, I don't know if I buy that. Again, this is also a pre-9/11 world. So I suppose we can let it fly. But
yeah, it never occurred to me to think anything of that, to be honest. But
it was weird.
Yeah,
you
make a fair point. Though
I mean, I guess somebody knows what's in it, but like he made it seem like, well, maybe there's a doctor down the hall, maybe he knows what's on the boxcar. And I'm like, oh,
just kind of looking at it, so shoulder shrug. Maybe someone on the train, we could maybe paper over it and say the conductor doesn't know, but maybe the engineer knows, and maybe somebody other than the conductor
knows. He's talking to Mulder and FBI, we're jumping way ahead, sorry, but he's talking to Mulder, an FBI agent, and he is like, I don't know. Maybe we could ask this dude. Like, I feel like if there was somebody that knew, he would have immediately gone.
He certainly doesn't think that there's someone that knows.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe knows that he doesn't know they know.
Maybe it's above his pay grade. Who knows? But it was
possible.
Weird. It was weird.
It is a little weird, but, you know, kind of necessary for the plot. So.
Right. And to answer your earlier question, or not to answer it, but to address it, the idea, I think, that they... it's happy, normal, fun train time, and the guy's waving at the kids, and everything's great, and then it suddenly turns dark, and then we are swapping out train cars, and people are meeting covertly, and suddenly we're like on a different train, heading to a different route, and it's all very, it's good visual storytelling, I think, but at the same time, you're not quite sure, like, the mechanics of what's happening, and I mean, we can kind of put this together as we talk about it, but... Yeah.
It all kind of fits in with the sort of theme on the X-Files that we see often when it comes to sort of sinister stuff happening, is that it always seems to happen in trains or in trucks. Yeah. And there's just this idea that I guess the planes are okay, but everything going on, all these sinister things are always happening in these kind of everyday forms of transportation. Mm-hmm. And this just kind of fits in with that, I suppose.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool.
It is cool.
It is a nice little opening. We can go to Mulder and Scully because they're watching the video. I wanted to point out, though, that Mulder says to her, come in. Just more evidence to the fact that, like, this isn't really her office. It kind of becomes her office. Like,
yeah, and it almost seems like she's pausing a little bit, like she knows he's watching something, and she's not sure if she wants to walk in while he's watching it. I don't know.
And it could be because she immediately, of course, makes the porn joke right after she comes in. But I just think that it's more, you know, this sort of thing happens a lot, like in the early season, she'll knock. Or she'll come in and kind of like poke her head in, and he'll be like, come in. And so I think it just further supports the evidence that, like, technically at this point in the series, like, this is not Scully's office. This is Mulder's office. Scully clearly has an office somewhere else, and she's coming down to see what Mulder's up to, or to see what their case is or whatever. That obviously, I think, changes later in the season or later in the series. But I just like to point it out because I think it's just an interesting little detail that just gives a little bit of a... tells a little bit of a bigger story, I think.
I like that idea, actually, because it just makes her presence, every time she's in the X-Files office, she's there because she wanted to go and make a little visit to the X-Files office.
Exactly.
Just where she is all day long. Right. She is literally choosing to be in the office at that particular moment, which I think is kind of sweet.
Yes, I love it, too. So I just wanted to point it. Point that out. I do love her easy joke about the porn. This isn't your usual brand
of
entertainment.
I can't, you know what? Yeah. I can never get enough Mulder porn jokes. It's all good with me.
Yeah. And I just, the comfort that they have with each other is just really nice that she's like, yeah, I can joke about this. It's funny. You know, I get the feeling that, like, she might have actually caught him once. And
she must. I mean, she obviously knows what his usual brand of entertainment is.
Exactly. And I think that's funny.
And she's just very chill about it. It's like just this kind of very easy friendship. And it says a lot. Just that little sort of joke that she makes. And they both kind of laugh. Like he's laughing, too.
No one's uncomfortable. No one's awkward.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. He doesn't feel like he's being, you know, made fun of or anything. They both think it's kind of hilarious, which is cute.
Right. And then it's funny, too. I mean, the way that kind of changes throughout, like later in in Chinga, I would say, when they're on the phone. Is it Chinga? When he's like clearly watching something, and we haven't really discussed this, but she's like, what are you watching? And he like he turns to like quickly turn it off. It's almost like things are starting to change a little bit. And so now I don't want her to know that that's what's happening.
Yeah, because, you know, you feel differently about your girlfriend seeing something like that than you do about your buddy seeing it.
Right. Or in this case, somebody you want to be your girlfriend. So I would say.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, we have digressed. But I do like the little shade that she throws at
Fox. It
was
good digression.
Yeah. The shade she throws at Fox here is funny.
Oh, yeah, that's very kind of self-aware, kind of almost a little cutesy, the one they aired on the Fox Network. This is even hokier than the one they aired on the Fox Network. I mean, but she kind of has to say it because this is 1995, and that autopsy video show was on a few months before this episode aired, just a couple of months.
Was it really?
For the first time. It aired. It's a little bit of my Wikipedia research today. But, you know, I remember the autopsy video being shown on Fox, and it was a special about this film, like, oh my God, is this alien autopsy film real? And so they had, you know, is this truth or fiction or whatever? Jonathan Frakes was the host, as a matter of fact. I'd forgotten that part. And this aired in August of 1995 for the first time, re-aired several times, including, quote unquote, coincidentally, the night before Nisei aired,
they
aired the autopsy special again. But this alien autopsy special in 1995 was huge. It was like, and I remember it was like a media sensation. Everyone was talking about it. I mean, no one really believed it, but you know, it was 1995 and like half the population still believed in UFOs at that point. So,
or at least was like very obsessed with them at the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So everyone was very into this. And so for them to be watching an autopsy video on the X-Files, you kind of have to reference that Fox special because everyone is thinking about it.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to address it. Or else it's just distracting.
This is the kind of self-awareness bit, like meta joke that I'm okay with. Like, this is fine. David joking about Mulder having a crush on Taya Leone, not fine. No. Those are the meta jokes I don't care for. So just saying.
Right. Well, I think it's a question, to me, it's a question of whether it takes you out of the scene and takes you out of the universe.
Yeah, which and I think the other one does.
I think this... the other one does. I tend to agree, but this one almost more firmly ensconces you in the universe.
It's like we're acknowledging
a universe. Yeah, this is a universe in which the alien autopsy show was on TV, just like the world that the viewer lives in. Hey, I saw that too. Mulder and Scully watched the same bit of TV as I watched.
Yeah.
So obviously Scully has watched that special as well because she knew.
Oh my god! I love this idea because that you just brought up that. Oh, by the way, this actually had just aired recently. Like, and the idea that like Scully's at home watching the alien autopsy on the Fox Network tickles me. I enjoy that.
Yeah, right.
Because she had to have watched it, right?
She had to have, and maybe you can just kind of, I feel like there's a fanfic here where like she said, no way am I going to watch this. You know, Mulder maybe teased her about it or something. And she's like, no, as if. And then she can't resist. When it comes down to it, she has to watch it.
I love it. Love it.
I love everything about it. And she may or may not have discussed it with Mulder afterwards. I don't know.
Right. Well, I mean, this conversation, if assuming that it didn't spur all of this really dramatic content, I think would have led into him going, what are you talking about, Scully? You watched the Fox Network? You watched the alien autopsy on the Fox Network?
I could have. Yeah. I'd love if someone wrote a whole fanfic about that, because I do love that whole sort of concept of Scully watching that and what exactly she discussed with Mulder about it.
I love that. So we have Mulder and Scully now going off. I love when they just kind of go off on their own to do things that probably most taxpayers would be like, what the fuck are you guys doing? Right? Like, they're literally off, like, going on a lead of, like, a video, an alien autopsy video. Like, okay, who did I buy this alien autopsy video from? It must be something. Let's go travel across the country. I love that so much. And even later when he has to kind of explain it to Skinner, even Mulder looks a little... like ashamed, kind of like,
piracy,
following. But I love that. So anyway, they follow the lead of the guy, whoever the guy is who has the alien autopsy video that he sold, who we find out, and I don't know if I made this connection before, but he was actually one of those guys on the list. Like he was a MUFON guy, but I didn't notice that his name was actually on that list. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I did see that.
But because they mentioned that he gets killed. Obviously, he's on the list because he's killing. But I don't remember if I ever visually noticed his name on the list before. But it was pretty cool, though. So this guy, and this was actually kind of a very chilling shot that I remember thinking, this is a bit much, even for this show.
It's
and
a
I
lot. Mean,
yeah. When they go into that bedroom and he's kind of got the pillowcase, it's like bloody and he's tied. His hands are bound. It's pretty intense. And Scully's
like murder scene. Hello.
Scully is very chill too. Very chill.
She's very chill.
I wanted
she's
to
like,
be
oh,
like,
murder.
She's like, Mulder, he's still warm. I would have been like, I mean, I know they're prepared to see this shit, but I mean, if I were to be like, Mulder, somebody dead in here. Like,
yeah, I know. I always find it weird that the only thing she says about him is that he's still warm. She never actually says he's dead, which would have been the first thing I would have said about him.
I mean, I get why she says he's still warm indicates that the guy is still in the room and we got to hurry. But like, it is a weird thing to say. It was straight, a little oddly written. I feel like she probably would have been a little bit more taken aback because I feel like the entire plane ride or car ride here, Scully has been probably rolling her eyes so hard, like, oh my God, are we really doing this? Are we really
this
falling?
This is all so stupid.
So I feel like she should be very surprised to see this dead guy.
Like, holy shit just got real. And they should not be necessarily expecting to encounter a murder
scene.
That's not the kind of crime they're picturing, I don't think, at this point. Although they know, like, the one of the doors has been kicked in, so they know there's been an intrusion.
Right.
But I don't think they were anticipating murder. So you think that, yeah, you'd think they'd be just mildly surprised, at least, to find a dead body. Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mulder could possibly have been expecting it, but he's not the one who found the body. So my point stands, I think. Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Scully
yeah,
was very chill. I'm going to chalk it up to her excellent FBI agent skills, but yeah. I thought but she would be a little bit more surprised.
And it definitely turns it into like a very important case at that point. Up until then, it just probably felt like a bit like a lark.
Yeah.
And at that point, it's suddenly very serious. It's right. a murder investigation all of a sudden.
They have something to do. Yeah.
They can actually be serious and important FBI agents at that point.
Right. And I mean, we have to be very thankful for this murder because it leads us to some very top tier Mulder running content.
Oh, it does.
I mean, I think only matched by Unruhe when he's running down the alleyway screaming, Skella! Or that's Fight the Future when he's stripping as he's running down the alleyway. There's a lot of great Mulder running content.
I would also argue we get some great running Mulder running content later on in this very episode when he's running, thinks he can actually run and chase and catch a train.
Yeah,
so
lots of it.
Quite a lot of good running.
And I think Mulder
content.
At least just visually, I know that Mulder has a stand-in, I know that David has a stand-in, but I feel like he did a lot of these stunts.
Oh, yeah. According to my Wikipedia research, and I'm really taking a lot of it with a grain of salt because I'm not totally sure I buy all of this. David did, quote unquote, all of his stunts in both Nisei and 731. I can't believe they actually let David Duchovny jump onto a train, but they claim that he did and that it took 6 weeks to get it right.
Wow.
So allegedly, David Duchovny did a lot of the stunts in this. I shall leave it to the viewer to determine how much. But that's the word, at least.
So David, so Mulder, I keep doing that. What is wrong with me this week, Jen?
It's all right.
There's something in the air.
I can't imagine what.
Mulder pulls his gun out and is got this guy cornered after all this amazing running content that we were just discussing. And there's more dogs. I know this. We always talk about like, oh, the dogs. Yeah, are the dogs really there? It's kind of scary. This whole scene is really well done. Really well shot scene. And tense. This guy kind of scares me. And I think it's also the fact that he's just looking at Mulder so stoically and not saying anything. And even though Mulder's doing his best, he's like, do you speak English? No, clearly he doesn't speak English, Mulder. Come
or at
on.
Least he's pretending.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think he does, but he does. Although he is kind of supposed to be like this diplomat, so I mean,
you
think he would.
Think he knows but basic maybe he English, is. But he's not cooperating, that's
he
for sure.
Certainly is not cooperating, and he is giving him the death eyes. Like,
Totally.
He scared me. I was actually kind of like, is he going to kill me with his vision? Like, it was scary. But Mulder. I do think it's funny that Mulder drops his gun. Is this a thing?
It
happens, but I can't off the top of my head think of the other times he drops his gun.
I honestly can't think of it off the top of my head, but I just remember at the time, the fandom as one were like, Mulder finally acknowledged that he drops his gun all the time. So I think as fans, we had somehow noticed that, but
right.
I honestly don't remember the other examples now, but obviously up to that point, Mulder had done it on a regular enough basis that fans had noticed it.
Okay, or enough times that fans had noticed it. That's really funny. I love that. And I love the fact that he has the one in his ankle holster or whatever.
Yes.
It is like.
And everyone flipped over that. Oh, yeah. Yay! Yeah. Mulder's finally carrying his like a gun.
He did a really good job coming back from that and subduing the suspect and getting him to the police station. I went on all by himself. Like, I was sitting here thinking, I mean, I know he ran a long way, but I was like, where's Scully? Where'd she go? I mean,
boy,
I guess maybe maybe she's just treating the guy or making sure he's dead, or I don't know,
I don't know. She backup. She maybe is like guarding the crime scene.
She should be,
like
I suppose. But
I don't
wonder.
Know, yeah,
I did wonder where it would happen to Scully. I was like, wait. She could be backing him up here. Like, I know Scully can't run it and keep up with Mulder on those little legs. I get it.
No one could expect to. But yeah, you'd think eventually she might at least attempt to show up.
Or have shown up.
I kind of feel like that's one of the scenes that drags on just a little too long for me. Mm-hmm. This whole interaction between Mulder and the suspect. It's like there's just a little more back and forth than I think is absolutely necessary.
I don't think any of it is necessary. I mean, I think that like, I like the Mulder dropping the gun moment and that, but I think literally he could have cornered the guy and been like, come on. And then the guy could have given him the death stare and then done.
And that would have been it. Yeah.
But it went on at least a minute too long. Yeah, I agree.
There's just a little more in there that absolutely had to be. And honestly, the karate thing, it feels a little stereotypical Japanese-y.
I didn't want to comment on those things, but I think we have to. I did notice, too, that like whenever a Japanese character would show up, like there would be like a Mark Snow Japanese twang on the soundtrack.
That was a little bit painful for me.
This is such an X-Files thing, though. Like, I feel like they do that like a lot in terms of the music, and I actually really enjoy the music, but I feel like when it's used in that way, it kind of does make me go, don't do that.
It's a little cringy, right? Yeah. It's a little bit, oh, look how Japanese they are. The music will tell you.
Right.
It's a little... Well, do you really have to? No. Were they gonna play like some kind of like oompa tuba music when they had Germans on? No.
But
they have to have some kind of quasi Japanese music when the Japanese characters are on screen. I don't know.
I suppose
they're doing anything that would be be perceived as like traditional Japanese.
No.
They happen to be Japanese scientists. That's all.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand the importance of them being Japanese in the story, like I understand that, but there's no need for the musical flourish. Like, like we're watching an episode like Hell Money where they're doing it for atmosphere. Like that is that makes sense. That's fine.
I can forgive that a bit more readily, but you're right. The Japanese culture is not really part of this story.
No, it's not. There's really no need for that. And I agree. I'm glad we brought it up because it did kind of bother me. And I was just like, oh, no.
But again, it's one of those things I would have thought nothing of in the 90s.
Exactly.
And I'm sure
exactly.
No one else did either. But I do kind of cringe when I watch it now.
Exactly. And I think the karate thing is another example of that. Like, well, he's going to do karate. Like, okay. Yeah. Like, I get it. It was a little unnecessary.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. But anyway, it is what it is. And we have it. And
1995, this is what we get.
There you go. So I do love when they're in the police station and Fulder refers to Skinner as a beacon in the night. I don't know why. I forgot.
He makes
the entrance? I forgot completely about this bit, and I found it so funny how he's like, it's a beacon in the night, and then we cut, and then Skinner's like walking in, and continuity clearly has an affinity for hookers.
He does give that hooker a look, right?
We aren't even to the hooker episode yet, but here we got Skinner going...
He's checking out
the hooker.
Yeah, I did kind of notice that. But yeah, he makes a spectacular entrance.
Yes.
I don't know what happened with the filming of that scene, but there is an enormous amount of smoky substance in that police station. I don't know what it's supposed to be. I feel like they wanted to put a little bit in for atmosphere, but maybe overdid it. But it makes for a particularly dramatic entrance by Skinner.
It was kind of unnecessarily dramatic, but I enjoyed it and it made me laugh, especially when he looked at the hooker and I was just like, oh my God, are we really doing this? And that was completely unintentional, but I just found it like to be a very funny coincidence.
So. That's kind of interesting. We can decide that that's like character continuity, that Skinner has a thing for.
I think we can. It tracks, yeah. Jen. It tracks.
It does kind of. So.
If it tracks, I will use it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have. Are you? Do you need anything else with this scene? Because I was going to move on to the gunman. Are you ready?
I am ready to move on. I'm always ready to move on.
Always ready for the gunman. Okay, so
bring on the gunman, baby.
We have the gunman. Yay! And that is one thing that Nisei has that 731 doesn't. So we will.
Yeah.
We'll give it that. It gets some points for that. So Scully, I'm supposing at this point, Mulder has sent off to check out the Allentown, the MUFON stuff.
It always irks me a little when Mulder's like, you do this and I'm going to do that. It's like, you're not, don't give Scully orders, but it makes sense that, you know, it's totally fine that they would, you know,
divide and
look
conquer
into these things separately. But it just, you know, You don't have to tell her what to do. She can figure it out for herself, Mulder.
Yeah.
But yes, yeah. Interestingly and coincidentally, Scully winds up being the one to investigate the MUFON stuff, which I'm sure we will discuss further.
It would have been interesting if Mulder had found that out and Scully had gone to the gunman. On many fronts, because I enjoy Scully with the gunman, first of all. But also, would Mulder have... how much would Mulder have shared with Scully?
Yeah, that would have really irked me, too, I bet.
Yeah, it would have been... I don't know. Mulder of here is different than, I think, Mulder of, like, season 5, for example, or season 4 Mulder, even. So, I don't know.
Even, like, I'm thinking about Memento Mori, where he just, you know, doesn't... Scully Nova in his pocket and telling her the whole story. It certainly is believable to me that he would not have told her the whole thing. Whereas Scully does tell Mulder the whole thing, which I appreciate, so that everyone's on the same page. I'm really glad that Scully was the one who went and talked to the MUFON women, so we didn't have to go through a whole thing with Mulder. Should I tell her, should I not? That would have driven me nuts.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess my point is I don't think they would have gone there at this point in the series.
No, you're right.
Like they did a year from now. So
absolutely. I'm glad they did.
But yeah, I'm glad it happened the way it did, although I would have enjoyed some Scully Gunman content.
Ah, yeah, that's always a delight.
But we do have, well, first of all, is Frohickey like wearing... Is he wearing a Wookiee vest? What is he wearing?
Is this like, it's like, I don't know, some kind of very fake fur vest?
It's bizarre, right? Like, what were they thinking?
I feel like this is just something that someone connected with the X-Files, just maybe Tom Braidwood himself, saw this at some point in like a secondhand clothing store and thought, this looks like something Frohickey would wear, and decided to pick it up.
It's very funny, and it made me do a double take, ridiculous. And I had to cleanse my eyes with Mulder in the turtleneck, thank God, because...
Thank God Mulder's wearing his one-breath turtleneck in that scene.
Yes. Ooh, something about that turtleneck.
God, yes.
I never thought that like a man in a turtleneck would really do it for me because it doesn't sound like it would. But
it doesn't sound like it, but that's sure a very does. Hot turtleneck. It's something about it. It's probably like a very, very expensive turtleneck because it's just cut really nicely and just drapes really nicely on his body. So,
and I mean, it helps that it is on Mulder. That's helpful,
well,
too.
Well, obviously, the man can wear some clothes, and that just somehow really flatters his figure in some fashion. I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, love it. We are here for the good content, folks.
Totally.
So they are figuring out that essentially what was in this briefcase, one of the satellite photos in the briefcase, are this ship.
Yes.
And
the ship.
Talipus.
The Talipus.
I don't know the meaning of that. Did you look that up?
I did not look up Talipus.
I'm curious, though. I'm going to look it up while we're chatting. Okay. But essentially we know that there's something on this ship that Mulder's going to go after.
And the lone gunman seems to know all about this ship. They're like, oh yeah, it's a salvage ship that was looking for this Japanese submarine that was supposedly full of gold or something like that. So they seem very up on it.
It looks like it's a lake in Seattle. Okay.
All right.
Talipus Lake. That's what I'm seeing.
I like saying it. Talipus.
It is very fun to say.
Talipus. Maybe I'll name my next dog Talipus. I don't know.
It'll get old after a while, I'm sure.
It probably would. I'll just go with Tally, which would be kind of cute, actually.
Oh, that is cute.
Yeah.
Mulder, of course, is going to go out and find this ship because it's his only breadcrumb. And I do like how they are able to sort of connect, like, the trail. Like, you were talking earlier about the trail, like, who goes where and why they go.
I have to kind of run through it in my mind because they do wind up in a lot of different places. But one, they did a nice job of writing this in, because it is a complicated trail. But one step does lead to the other. Mm-hmm. And the ship, the finding the briefcase from the murderer diplomat guy leads to finding these satellite photos, which leads to the gunman, which leads to learning that the ship is in this naval yard in Virginia, which leads to Mulder going to that naval yard in Virginia.
Right. But before he goes... Wait, no, he's hopping all over the place, right? Because he's
a hippin', hoppin' and kind of guy.
He's clearly back in D.C. with the gunman. And then he goes back out to this shipyard, right?
Yes.
Where he sees in Virginia, which is close, I guess it's relatively close to DC.
Yeah.
It's not like he's gone all the way to Allentown. It's not all super far, so I guess it's not that big of a deal. But he goes and he sees what we can assume is another UFO, right?
I mean, that's... certainly looks that way. I mean, first he's on the ship, which does turn out to be the Talipus, I guess. This is another one of those things that I probably would have edited out because he doesn't find anything, I don't think, of significance on the ship. And then all of these armed men descend for reasons that are, again, unclear.
Yeah.
He jumps into the water. He jumps out of the water. And then he sees the UFO. I'm not sure we needed that stuff on the ship at all.
It feels just, yeah, like a lot of filler. Like, I do think that there is quite a bit of filler in this episode for the sake of making, like you said, 1.5 episodes into 2.
Yeah.
But again, it's probably was the better decision than attempting to cram this all into one. So, you know, they were like, oh, let's just throw in some more action. Not can't hurt. Let's throw in more Mulder running and sweaty and wet. I'm not going to complain.
Yeah. So. I mean, it never troubled me at the time. I was not bored watching it. That's for sure.
Right. It's just, upon rewatch, we can sort of pick these things apart.
Yeah. You're not really like getting a lot of interesting sort of development.
Yeah.
But, you know, they are entertaining enough scenes in and of themselves. And then, we see the what we are meant to think, I think, is a UFO. It looks very mysterious.
This is, like, very similar to the scene in Deep Throat where he sees something very similar, but is then, like, brain fogged or whatever, and he loses his memory and then can't remember what he saw. But I feel like those scenes are very similar.
They are.
But except this time, he sees it and he remembers it and he's very aware that he's seen it. And is this the second or third or fourth UFO Mulder has seen at this point?
Yeah,
he's seen quite a few. And Scully
finds himself in the UFO places all the time.
Right. This is why and Scully couldn't have gone to the gunman.
Well, exactly, because we can't have her seeing it.
Right.
And it's one of those, it's a little tenuous to me in terms of the narrative that I guess the only reason he sees that is because he went to see the ship, and then as he escapes from the ship, he, I guess, just stumbles upon this warehouse where the UFO is being kept. I guess because they just...
They just took it off the ship. I mean, it would have been...
put it in the nearest warehouse to wherever the ship was.
It's weird.
You think they would take it to a military facility or something?
Yeah, or at least like that he could have just found it on the ship instead of having all of this work around. And again, like it's just like they're just probably location issues or whatever. There's probably a million reasons, but just a little weird, strange narrative choice, like you said. But again, it's just all very mystifying on purpose, probably.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be confusing. It's supposed to work at it. Mulder goes home. I guess he just leaves Scully in Allentown, which he tells Skinner. Yeah. I don't know where she is.
I left her in Allentown.
And again, like I said, I guess it's not that far, and maybe he just took the train back or the train something. But Skinner is waiting in his apartment. It's very, very dark and mysterious and kind of, again, unnecessarily dramatic, right? Like,
why would he just be sitting there in the dark? Like, he's lucky that Mulder didn't shoot him, because
he really is.
Like, an armed man, a law enforcement officer comes to his home. It's clearly been broken into. He's going to be armed and ready to take on whoever's in there.
Yeah.
So Skinner would have really had no one to blame but himself if Mulder had shot him.
I agree. I wonder, too, like he was remarkably calm considering that Mulder was within his rights to shoot this intruder in his place. Mulder would have been off scot-free for killing Skinner. And I'm glad he didn't, but I'm just saying.
It was a bit of a very weird, strange choice from Skinner.
Yeah, weird.
But it adds to the drama, but not in a super realistic way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with adding drama, but where it's necessary. I mean, I feel like he could have just called him up and been like, you know, where's the briefcase? Don't get your nose into this case. But it was meant to be very threatening. And I mean, if I recall at this point when you're watching this show live, like we're still not quite sure what's up with Skinner in terms of like, okay, he's trying to help them, but he's also like, they've made him out to be kind of very threatening and ominous in this episode. And so maybe we're kind of flipping back on Skinner here. Like we don't know who's talking to him or if he's been sent to sort of get Mulder in line and I get all of that, but it was the whole scene was a little odd. So.
Yeah, we don't really need that whole scene again. I think the only information that gets delivered, I mean, we already know about the diplomat, so I'm not really sure that he delivers anything in that scene that we didn't kind of already know, except to be all like, this is all like really super important and too much for us.
I think what we're supposed to get out of this is this, the fact that he is being told to not pursue it, which Skinner should know by now is the most surefire way to get him to pursue it.
Yeah. And I think I kind of get the impression that Skinner knows that.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like, well, Skinner's kind of like, I'm out. And Mulder just kind of nods a little bit. And mm-hmm. I kind of get the feeling that Skinner, he's not necessarily saying, if you continue with this, you're fired. It was more like, this is a big deal. And I just don't want to be involved in it.
Yeah.
And so you just do whatever you got to do, but I don't want to know about it. That's kind of how I read that.
That is fitting with his, you know, his character overall throughout the entire arc, even when he, you know, even up through the revival, when he'll say something like, I always wanted you guys to do the things that I didn't have the courage to do, you know?
Yeah. And this is a good example of that.
Yeah, exactly. So good scene, just strange setup, I would say. So we get Senator Matheson again.
Senator Matheson is back. It's the first time we see him since Little Green Men, right?
Exactly. And I feel like it's the last time we're going to see him in a while. Because I recall, and we might talk about this in one of our upcoming mythology episodes, but from what I recall, the next time Mulder tries to talk to him is in Wet Wired, and he has like been silenced. Like, he cannot get a hold of him. And then we don't hear from him again until like season 6 or something.
Yeah.
So clearly, Matheson telling Mulder where to go here is going to have repercussions for him.
Yes.
Which I find really interesting, because this was not like a plot point that was just dropped. Like, this is a plot point that has a logical ending. Like, it makes sense why this guy stopped showing up to me.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So that's cool. I liked this scene. I liked the dialogue. It was a little, you know, heavy-handed, but I think that's the idea. Like, I like the stuff about the chess, playing the chess and like knowing which pieces to knock off the board. That sounded to me so much like Smoking Man that I think in my headcanon, Matheson is a syndicate member. So I think that this kind of maybe helps that theory a little bit. I feel like he is one of the, maybe if he is a syndicate member, he's a well manicured man type. Like, he's obviously trying to help Mulder, but he's getting punished for it, clearly. So,
I think the dialogue in this scene is a little sort of not super casual conversation, but it that kind of thing normally irks me, but I'm totally fine with it. I think that's just kind of Senator Matheson just likes to talk that way, I think, because it makes him feel special and important. And Mulder likes to kind of play along because that's
Mulder
the way the senator is.
Yeah,
it's like, look at us, we're doing special, important, and very high level stuff. We're all very high level in this right now.
Did you notice that it seems like Mulder even combed his hair to see the senator?
I didn't notice that. No. You're right. Now that I think about it, yeah.
His hair just looked so pressed down. I was like, oh, he combed his hair because he was going to see the senator. I don't know. I just like that. I thought that was cute.
He does look different. You're right. He's all clean cut.
I don't know if that's intentional, but I'm making it intentional. So
yeah, absolutely. Makes sense.
So
going
he
to
gets
see the senator.
Yeah, you gotta go to see the senator. You gotta look your best. Put on your Sunday best. Comb your hair.
Absolutely.
You know? I love it.
The whole and incidentally, during the whole scene in the senator's office, I kept yelling, "Play some Bach!"
Yeah,
because that's of course was part of Little Green Men, and I really just really enjoyed that aspect of the scene. So I was hoping they were going to do it again, but they did not. They just, you know, quite sensibly just sat close together and spoke in low tones. Mm-hmm. That was probably sufficient.
Yeah, they got straight to shop talk. It's okay.
They did.
They had a lot of shit to get through.
They did. Senator Matheson was full of information.
He really was. It was helpful. And I do enjoy the fact that Scully, I mean, luckily has arrived back at this point. We gotta go talk about the Scully storyline, obviously.
Yeah.
But I do enjoy that, like, he shares it with her right away, and it's like, this is all the stuff I just got. Like, let's move on this, you know. Yeah. And before we go to that, let's actually go back and discuss Scully's the adventures of Scully in Allentown, because this is major shit.
This is major shit. Absolutely it is.
I'm going to let you talk about this a little bit, because I know how much you enjoy talking about Scully's abduction.
I do. So Scully shows up at Betsy Hagopian's house because her name was on the list that they found in the briefcase of the fellow whom I have dubbed the murderer diplomat guy. And so Scully's going to her house to kind of further investigate the murder.
And I mean, I'm sure she's worried that these people are next.
She might. She's probably half expecting to show up and find someone dead in that house.
Yeah.
So she's just trying to sort of make sure everyone's okay. Mm-hmm. See what light they can shed on the murder. So she shows up planning to do that. I find it interesting when she shows up at the house and a woman who apparently whose name is Lottie.
I didn't know that either. Yeah.
Apparently Lottie Holloway is her name. The dark haired woman who answers the phone, not the door. I've always found it interesting the fact that Scully is trying to introduce herself as she always does. She can't seem to find her ID. She's checking all her pockets and she's having trouble pulling out her ID to say, I'm Agent Dana Scully from the FBI, blah, blah, blah. She doesn't get to that point. And during that period of time when Scully is sort of, for some reason, thrown off looking through her pockets, Lottie figures out, hey, I know who you are. And who else is there but dear Penny Northern, whom we get to know better later on.
Yeah.
And I'm all like, Penny! And and right away, Lottie especially recognizes Penny, recognizes Scully. And I think that Penny does too, as she is one of us, which mm-hmm. is all very like mysterious at that point. And Scully's like, I'm one of what? Mm-hmm, who? But to me, it always seemed like Scully was a little thrown by her initial encounter with Lottie because she is a little sort of like she never has trouble finding her FBI ID. It's always at the same place. So she yeah. seems just a little thrown. So I feel like maybe from the very beginning, she maybe recognizes Lottie on some level, too, or there's something about her.
Oh, that's an interesting theory. Okay, that's I was wondering where you were going with that, because I was like, okay, wait, is there a reason that she didn't find her ID? Did she ever pull it out? Yeah. Was there a storytelling reason that she couldn't pull her yeah. ID out? And I'm like, I can't think of anything. I just was always under the impression that that was an added element to her being sort of flustered and kind yeah. of like, wait. No, you have this wrong. What? But I really like that theory. I like the idea that she kind of, because she does kind of look at her and goes, like, hi, I'm, and then she kind of goes yeah. for it. But
you're
right.
Patrol.
She's processing something. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. And that's yeah. probably why immediately that she looks so freaked out and not just like, you know, you're mistaken. I've never met you. Because that seems like right. a more accurate Scully response, which would be like, I'm sorry, I don't think that
yeah.
you have the right
what?
Person.
Yeah.
But she would be like, wait, what? Like, what? Like, she seemed very, yeah, yeah that's a good point. I like
she
that.
She was a little thrown, like, but, you know, she's trying to sort of establish, but you know I'm not one of your group, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
she's saying it in a bit of an odd sort of way that I wouldn't mm-hmm. expect her to say. She's not, like, matter of fact about it.
No.
I don't know you guys, right? But she still kind of feels like, I don't know you though, like, but there's something about the way she's doing it
telling me. Yeah.
Yeah. She's a little sort of, she's not sure. She mm-hmm. doesn't sound as sure as you would expect her to.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
and,
a good point. Yep.
And then it takes quite a turn as soon as Lottie says, did you have an unexplained event in your life last year? Were you missing for a period of time that can't be accounted for? And as soon as she says that, we know that, oh, wow, they do know Scully. And Scully gets it right away. Mm-hmm. She's like, okay, there's something real going on here. And she doesn't doubt that at that point that they know something about her.
Yeah.
And she's very shocked. And then it's like, let's get the band together. They immediately get the rest of the women over there. They've all got, like, things to tell her. Scully throughout this is very like, no, I cannot write with all of this right now. I don't think she disbelieves any of it. She doesn't go into kind of skeptical Scully mode and say, nope, nope, this has nothing to do with me. I'm out of here, which is one way that it could have gone, because that's the way Scully sometimes deals with this sort of thing. But I find it interesting that she doesn't seem at all disbelieving, but just kind of readily sort of admits, I'm not ready to discuss this.
Right. Which is kind of similar to how she behaved in Paperclip.
Yeah.
So, I mean, slight a slight shift maybe in willingness to believe, but I feel like maybe that's a huge purpose of this two-parter in terms of Scully's characterization, is she now has this really, really legitimate reason to start to believe in this. I really enjoy that. I think that's, this whole scene I think is really cool. Do you, remind me again, as you're watching this live, is this the first time that we have learned that there are other women that this happened to?
I believe it is.
Because we didn't know prior that, like, there were other people taken with Scully. Like, this was the first time we're learning that information.
Certainly not like this. I mean, obviously, there's been, you know, X-Files stories about other UFO abductees, quote unquote, but certainly not like this. And it's very chilling. Mm-hmm. It's very striking and very well done. And when they all bring out those chips that apparently they all carry around with them.
Yeah.
Scully is just so freaked out. I mean, when they mention about the mark, well, you have the mark, don't you? The mark on the back of your neck. I love that moment and the way Jillian acts that, where she just kind of closes her eyes for just a second, like, oh, fuck. Yeah. They have marks on the back of their neck. This is real. And
it's that proof that she
is
always looking for. Yeah.
They have the proof. Mm-hmm. They have the chips. They have the mark. They have memories that are similar to hers. And that's when we start to see Scully having flashbacks that we've never seen her have before, that are, you know, obviously similar to what the other women are telling her happened to them.
Yeah.
And so it's starting to come back to her. And like Penny says, you know, you're probably going to start to get these memories come back. They all specifically talk about men having done experiments on them, which is interesting. Then I don't believe those women ever really mention anything about aliens or UFOs, just that they were taken and experimented on by men.
Well, and I think that they weren't. So,
yeah. And they don't seem to believe that which is kind of interesting that they're all part of, you know, MUFON, but they don't seem to think that there's an alien component to this. Whereas a lot of abductees who probably weren't taken by aliens often think that it was aliens.
Right. Or, I mean, we don't necessarily know what they believe exactly other than it was men. I mean, because the truth obviously lies somewhere in the middle.
Absolutely.
And we just haven't quite figured that out yet. So, but it is interesting. I do like the idea that they target these MUFON people because they know that they're going to be dismissed as crazy. I find that idea fascinating.
So clever, right?
Yeah, very clever. And like these people are targets for that reason. And I mean, they obviously carry this idea throughout the show, even in all those their little experimental episodes about like the nature of truth, like Jose Chung and a lot of those. I find that really fascinating that these people were targeted, and it seems like, oh well, what a coincidence. No, it's intentional. Like it makes perfect sense. Really enjoy that. Really like
it's rarely sort of explicitly stated, but it makes total sense. And it would be kind of a very sort of clever, sinister thing to do. And it just feels very kind of sinister to take advantage of people who already have sort of these unusual beliefs that make them kind of cast outs in society to a certain extent, and to take advantage of that. And to take advantage of these people who are vulnerable in unique ways, and to victimize them, and knowing that they could get away with victimizing them because of their specific vulnerabilities. It's just particularly sinister to me.
It is. That's a really, really good point. And it's worth mentioning, sorry, Jen, that due to canon, we are to believe that Diana Fowley at this time is coming around and sort of cleaning up this... these people that have been, you know, abducted and cleaning up the evidence and stuff, which I find absolutely fascinating to think, you know, obviously they hadn't thought of that at this point. But I mean, in the show canon, in the stories that we're told, that we're to believe that that's what's happening right now. And
that's true.
And that's really fascinating. I find that really cool.
She's such a horrible person.
Oh, come on.
Leave those poor people alone, Diana Fowley.
All right. Well, that's a conversation we don't need
to have.
I had
not thought of that before and will never again, probably. But,
oh, well.
But fair point.
Jen, I promise you, when we get to season 6, you will think of it again.
I will have to. I know. I have no choice.
I love how this transitions into the scene with her and Mulder, because when Scully is, like we said, when she's presented with the proof that she has, she is understandably freaked out, goes directly to Mulder and is like, this is what happened.
It tells him the whole story.
Everything. And he's like, but you're fine. And she goes, am I? And that's such a really, really meaningful exchange for them to have, especially considering what Frank said when we talked to him on the podcast about how this was a plot point that had seemingly eventually been dropped, and like he wanted to pick it back up later. And I mean, it's believable that, you know, maybe Scully was special for some reason and maybe wasn't going to get sick for that reason. They could have gone that route, but Frank was like, no, this makes sense, this is what has to happen. And I mean, the pieces are all there. They had planted them. And I find that really cool that they have this little conversation that maybe means that even on some subconscious level, Scully has been fearing this since season 3, or even preparing for it. Absolutely. Even though they don't mention it again until Leonard Betts. They don't bring
absolutely.
It up. But
and I mean,
it's on her mind.
And, you know, according to sort of what we've been told, they weren't really planning to tell the cancer story at that point, if ever.
Right.
And so to have done this episode and then not to bring it back up again would have really annoyed me. So as it is, though, it's this really, you know, incredible foreshadowing of what's to come. And it's such a very, you know, sort of sensibly placed puzzle piece in Scully's story that, you know, we have the abduction in season 2, we have this really significant development and the ones in 731 in season 3, and then we have the cancer in season 4. It all sort of connects together in a really interesting and effective, and like, it's hard to believe they didn't plan it that way kind of way. And I mean, that line that Penny says, we're all dying, it's, she just says it so sort of like matter of fact.
She's,
it's so chilling to me.
Yeah,
she's accepted it, and to hear that it's quite terrifying. And Scully, like, she buys it. She's not convinced that she's okay. She's not in her, you know, as she sometimes is, I'm fine Mulder mode. She's like,
no.
I don't know, I am fine.
Yeah.
She actually has been really, truly rattled by this.
And
I'm so glad that this wasn't the end of it.
Right. Like, it seems to me like such an obvious foreshadow that, did you kind of forget about this? Like, I mean, I know obviously it was such a huge shock to everyone in season 4 when it turned out that she was sick. But like, when you found that out, you were probably initially shocked. And then when you thought about it, you're like, well, that makes sense. But like, was it wasn't something that you think like the fandom was expecting or was anticipating?
I don't remember. No, I don't recall it that way. Other fans might recall it differently. And please tell me if you do. But my recollection is that it was kind of like, interesting, but I didn't really have an expectation that it would pay off or where it was going. There was always in the back of my mind, like, you know, we haven't seen the end of this Scully abduction story. There's got to be more to it.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, I don't know why I wasn't expecting her to suddenly have cancer, because I was kind of shocked once she did, although it did make sense.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I wasn't expecting it, and I don't know why. I guess I just kind of thought, maybe enough time had passed since this episode.
Yeah, I was just going to say that enough
that
time
kinda
had
thought
passed.
If it was going to happen, it would have happened either within this two-parter or later on in season 3. But once enough time had passed, it's like, well, I guess maybe those women, there was something unique about those women. They all lived in Allentown. They obviously have connections with each other that Scully doesn't necessarily have with them. Obviously, she has a lot in common with them, but they are maybe their own little group that had slightly different experiences. So for whatever reason, I didn't think much of it. At the time, it just seemed more like a storytelling device to sort of for Scully to learn more about her chip. And so it was more going to be about, what is the story of Scully's chip? And will we find out more about that? Not so much about what's going to happen to Scully's health. That just seemed to be kind of a narrative way of her wanting to find out more about her chip.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes sense.
That's the way I took it at the time. But looking back on it, I kind of feel silly that I didn't, that I wasn't waiting on a weekly basis for Scully's cancer diagnosis.
It's interesting.
But it's just, that was the X-Files. Things come up and some of them just never really go anywhere. And so you can't wait on everything, I guess. I was always just waiting for anything to do with Scully's abduction, so I never really knew or cared what it was going to be.
Right. I wanted to bring up the fact that, like, she is so certain that she remembers this guy. Like, she is trusting her memory above everything mm-hmm. else, which I find is really interesting and fascinating. I think it's not yeah. it's not out of character. I just think in certain moments, I feel like she's more apt to believe, like, her own eyes or her own memory yeah. or something. And this is one of those that she is just so certain.
Sure, that she's going to be.
I do think it's funny, not that this has anything to do with this or is even a continuity error, but she says, I know this guy. And then Mulder makes a comment that's like, unless you were in Japan the past 50 years, you don't know him. Whereas they actually made a brief mention of her having been in Japan, stationed in Japan when she was a young girl. I think it was like in Emily or Christmas Carol, one of those episodes, they have a picture of her like in Japan. She's a child. Yeah. So it's, again, this is not a continuity error I'm pointing out, but I just thought it was really funny that he said that. And then later they made a point to like point out the fact that she had been in Japan.
Matter of fact.
Yeah. Right. Because it's just, it is kind of a like a cool little connection, you know, like yeah. she happened to have been there even for just a yeah. little while. I find that really
true. Like, don't assume cool. Mulder. She may have been in Japan and she was
exactly
yeah
but I thought that was funny. Okay, so yeah. We gotta talk about Pendril.
It's his first appearance.
It is, and I love him so much in this episode.
So great. This is maybe his best appearance.
I agree. I mean, he's great, I think, in all of his appearance, but this is by far his best. He just is like great. So cute and precious, the way he smiles at her, and he's just mm-hmm. so like non-threatening and adorable and like,
oh yeah,
keep it up yourself. And then he's like, oh, what a doof. I just love how he calls himself a doof.
It's so perfect. It's everything cute. About his interactions. And he's, you know, and he's not just a goofy guy who's got a crush on Scully, because who wouldn't? He's very smart and resourceful, yeah. and he knows his stuff, and he can be very serious as well.
I think that in another world where I didn't ship Mulder and Scully, I think they would have had a nice little relationship. I think
they would have been very cute together.
Very cute together. I can imagine them like on dates, like talking about science and just being all precious.
Yeah. And he would have treated her like a queen.
He really would have. I mean,
as she deserved.
It would have been a nice angle to see that happening. I would have enjoyed that.
I would have enjoyed it too.
He's so cute and I love him. And yeah, he would have treated her well. And you know, rest in peace, Pendril. At some point,
yeah,
we'll get to your
he deserved better. I mean, he didn't. He was not destined to have Scully in his life, but he maybe deserved at least to hang around.
Yeah, I have some happiness. Oh God, now I'm sad.
I'm a little sad about Pendril now.
Pendril,
we love you, Pendril.
We do love Pendril. I love the idea. Oh, and I love the idea that Scully has to. She kind of catches herself entertaining the possibility that this is an extraterrestrial thing, because she says, so you're saying this is man-made, and he's like, well, what else would it be? And like, she has
like,
to kind of go
grow in nature.
Yeah, so. She kind of has to go, oops, like, because she you know, subconsciously in her mind or even consciously is entertaining this.
She's almost kind of surprised that it's not extraterrestrial.
Since we are going to go into 731, but like, there's so much important information we get about Scully's chip that like, its potential and its ramifications, like none of this goes away when this episode ends. Like, this stays with, whether they mention it or not or reference it or not, that chip is part of Scully throughout the entire series.
Yeah.
Even when she gets it back in, it's out now, but when she gets it back in season 5 or when they, you know, after her cancer and all that, the chip is there and it mm-hmm. stays. And, you know, it is presumably that though now more under the control of Smoking Man, which makes it even mm-hmm. more sinister at that point. But the idea that we hear in this, and we don't hear again, but the idea that we hear in this, that this could record your every thought and know everything going on in your mind. And then adding that up with the fact that Smoking Man later has access to this makes so much sense to me.
Yeah.
In a very creepy and terrifying way. It makes sense that Smoking Man has this sort of strange obsession with Scully, that he knows so much about her, that he has the control over it. Like, she says repeatedly, he held my life in his hands. Like, it's very, very creepy and scary. Yeah. And again, but it makes sense. It totally does.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very scary. And it really kind of, and we'll talk about this when we get there, when it really adds to the weight of her decision in Redux to have the chip put back in, because why would you want that thing inside your body? But yeah. It's either that or you're going to die. It's just, it's not an easy decision necessarily. It's not like, oh, throw that chip back in, it's all going to be good.
No.
That chip is problematic. And yeah, it's very significant over the course of the series.
Yeah. That is one thing that, I mean, they do definitely bring it back on occasion, particularly in NME. I think they talk about the idea of the chip and the immortality mm-hmm. and all of that stuff, which I think people can forget. It's so briefly mentioned, but it's there. It's very important. And it's just one of those things that I think it's easy for people to forget that is always part of Scully.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, God, this scene with Pendrell, I just find it fascinating when they're talking about the implications of that. I think it's really cool.
It's very interesting.
So we briefly, before we go into the next episode, I just wanted to talk about this character, the red-haired man, which I think is the weirdest name. He doesn't even have red hair.
His hair is not red. No. I mean, I'm trying to see it in different lights in the episode and try to figure out where it came from.
No,
but
there's no
red.
It's
not even a little bit red. There's not even a red undertone. I don't know what happened there.
Wait, they should have called him the piano wire man.
Yeah, or something. Or, you know, that the NSA guy.
Yeah, but that sounds scarier, too.
Yeah, like, it's quite terrifying.
I mean, because I think that this guy with his piano wire is one of the most scary, like, you know, syndicate cronies that we've seen in a while, like, you know, and he's
very scary.
He's intimidating. And he like, even when Mulder later gets, you know, the wire around his neck, and like that whole time, like, I have a weird thing with like neck, like I can't watch neck stuff. And so like, when like Mulder's holding his neck, or David had clearly, or somebody had made the choice to have him kind of doing this with his neck, like throughout all that scene, I can feel how much that probably stings. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just like, oh,
yeah. Please.
Oh, but he
they did a great, they did a great job with the makeup on that. It was very scary and real looking. And it didn't freak me out that much when I watched it at the time. But since then, I've had thyroid surgery. And so I have a huge scar on my neck, kind of in the same general vicinity where Mulder's was. And so now it really freaks me out, because that scar kind of freaks me out a little bit when I think about, oh God, they opened me up and took out my thyroid. So it freaks me out more now than it did then. But now I'm like, oh no, don't show me that. It's just too many hospital flashbacks.
Oh my goodness.
Yikes.
But then this whole scene where we don't get quite to them on the train together yet before we get into 731, but coming up is one of your favorite parts, right, Jen? When Mulder and Scully are on the phone and Scully says, don't get on the train, and he jumps on
about like 12 times.
Yeah
Don't get on the train, I'm gonna get on the train, don't get on the train, I'm gonna get on the train. And that just goes on, and eventually he gets on that train.
Yeah, he does. I mean, and that's the show right there, I guess.
And then he drops his phone immediately, which is also just classic.
It is. It isn't meant to be funny. It's one of those things. I think we talked about this on our funniest lines.
Yeah, I think I put it down as one of my funniest moments, because I don't know why, but I find it. I think maybe I find it funny because people have done such a great job of making fun of it since then.
Yeah.
Like, when you're watching it within the context of the episode, it's not that funny, but have done so many great parodies of it that it makes me laugh now when I watch it.
It is now just sort of a meme when you watch it. It's not
of a meme.
Yeah.
It's just a living meme.
Why? I have a question, though, before we head into the next episode. Why is Scully not telling Mulder that it's X telling her? Like, why is she keeping this?
I wrote that exact question down in my notes. Like, why? Because he's skeptical about the information she's giving him. And rightly so. Where did you get this from? If she just said, because your ex fella is here and telling me that, I think he put a lot more credibility in it,
or
at least have more information to make a decision.
I mean, and I'm not defending Mulder's decision to just ignore Scully at all, because I think that is very rash. It's very Mulder, but it was very rash of him.
Well, it gets him into trouble.
Right. But I think that he, to his credit, I guess, he's probably just thinking, oh, this is just typical Scully worry. You know, like she just, you know, like she just doesn't want me to get hurt. Like there's no real reason that I can't get on this train other than Scully.
Scully's always trying to tell him not to do things.
Scully got a Scully. I mean, and I gotta say, that's probably what he's thinking. And I mean, in a way, that's kind of her fault because she's not telling him, I have a source here telling me this. It's not just me literally saying, don't get on the train. They know where you are. Blah, 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 blah.
For that matter, I don't see why she couldn't have even passed the phone over to Mr. X. Maybe he refused to talk to Mulder, but he always talks to Mulder. So I don't know why he'd be willing to talk to Scully and not Mulder. She could have just handed the phone. Well, this guy will tell you. And as soon as he heard Mr. X, he would have been like, okay, maybe I need to think about this.
Yeah, again, it just kind of felt like one of those things that was unnecessarily dramatic. Like the way the scene was written out was for dramatic effect, and it kind of outweighed the logic of it.
Yeah, because she had ample time to tell him why she believed this, and she didn't for some reason. It makes no sense.
It really doesn't. But again, they're they're both kind of being slightly idiotic in this scene.
Yeah,
but
maybe we can maybe hand wave it by saying they're just both really stressed out at that moment and maybe not thinking entirely clearly.
Yeah, and that's fine.
Let's go with that. And I mean, Mulder and Scully being Mulder and Scully, it's interesting to me how there's an interesting exploration through both Nisei and 731 in terms of what Scully, where she stands in terms of belief. And oftentimes people sort of like just dismiss Scully as, oh, she's so like, you know, stubborn and hard-headed. She just will not believe. She's like, it's all been laid out for her. But I love the fact that when Mulder and Scully are back in the X-Files office and they're talking about, you know, Mulder's visit with Senator Matheson, that, you know, Mulder is still convinced that there's an alien-human hybrid and Scully doesn't believe that. I love the fact that they refer back to Paperclip, for one thing, a little continuity shout-out, talking about, hey, you told me about those beings moving past you when we were in the tunnel that time, which thank goodness they addressed that.
Yeah, that they talked about it.
That's one of those things I think that they talked about it. And it was one of those things at the time the fans were like, how can Scully deny this now? So it's kind of nice to hear Mulder address that directly. And I love that. And, you know, he's all like, why do you refuse to believe? And I love the line that Scully says. I love both lines. Scully says, believing is the easy part, Mulder. I just need more than you. I need proof. So Scully's not like, you know, refusing to believe this stuff. She's not like, I've seen all this stuff, but duh, I don't believe in aliens. It's just she just wants the proof. She just goes about it in a different way. And I also find it interesting, Mulder's response, which is, you think believing is easy? Because he's a man, he proceeds on faith. When it comes to this, and Scully proceeds on fact, and each kind of thinks the others, you know, they go about it in different ways. And in some ways, Scully thinks, oh, you know, believing whatever, shoulder shrug, the facts are the hard part. But it's interesting to sort of hear Mulder's side of this, that, you know, faith isn't easy. You know, it's not that easy just to kind of believe day in and day out in any kind of faith. I think would fall into that category. I mean, Scully's religious faith, I'm sure she would say, you know, it's not always easy to keep that faith. Mm-hmm. And so this is similar, because you hear about, you know, crisis of faith. It's often used in a religious sort of context, but it's interesting to sort of hear Mulder talking about, you know, hanging on to his faith isn't always easy. And we certainly see his crisis of faith, you know, to come in season 5 and throughout the episode now and again. And so it's interesting to hear him talk about that, you know, believing isn't easy. And so it's an interesting sort of dichotomy between Mulder and Scully there. And I like the fact that I think that Mulder is comparing Scully to Senator Matheson at one point, because Scully says at the end of that scene, where did you get this information? And Mulder says, from someone like you who wants proof, who's also willing to believe. And I take that to mean that he's like you in the sense that he wants proof, Senator Matheson. Senator Matheson is also like you in the sense that he's willing to believe and you're willing to believe. And I think that's kind of like a lovely thing for Mulder to say about Scully, that number one, he's comparing her with Senator Matheson. And we know he kind of has a crush on Senator Matheson. So It's high praise indeed to compare her with him. And I think he's showing that he appreciates that Scully is willing to believe she just needs the facts.
Yeah, I was wondering about that line too, because I think you could read that line in a... Oh my God, sorry, my cat's knocking shit off the thing.
That's what cats do.
They do. Now she's staring at it. Sorry. You could read that line, I think, two different ways. But the reason that I agree with you and it's your reading is because I feel like if they meant for him to sort of be petulant or be sort of rude, then I think they would have worded it a different way. Like, I think they would have worded it like, someone like you who wants proof, except he's willing to believe. I feel like he would have said something I think that who's also willing to believe is, I think you're right. I think he is saying that because he believes Scully is willing to. She just needs the proof. So he's comparing them. Like you said, I like that.
And I haven't always seen it that way. I think the first time I watched this, I kind of thought he was saying he's like you in the sense that he wants proof, but he's willing to believe.
Right.
But then when I watched it a bit more carefully in the context of the whole conversation where she says that she's willing to believe.
Yeah.
It makes more sense that he's saying, you know, like you, he is also willing to believe. And it just shows like an appreciation for Scully's willingness. And you're right. It's the way it's worded and also the way it's delivered, I think, that he doesn't sound frustrated.
Right. It's sweet. It's sort of gentle the way he says it. It's not like typical. Like it's not like, I don't want to say typical Mulder dickishness, but when Mulder can be dickish, it's not in,
when
it's
he's,
not
yeah,
in
when
that.
He's getting frustrated.
Yeah, it's not in that tone. So I agree.
No, it's not. So I've never really thought of that as kind of like a shippy moment before, but I do now in sort of like the years since I first watched it, I've started to see it more as that reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually kind of like it. I think it's kind of a lovely moment between them that he is appreciating that. I think it just demonstrates that Scully is closer to where Mulder is than sometimes viewers give her credit for.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not complete polar opposites.
Yeah.
Scully just wants the facts.
Right.
But she's still willing to believe. They're not like completely the opposites.
It is a nice, slightly shippy moment in a two-parter that's kind of sadly devoid of ship.
There's not a lot of it, but I'm going to find it where I can.
We will find it wherever it exists, and that's definitely worthwhile. I actually really enjoy that conversation, too. I mean, it's a great Mulder-Scully scene, but I think it also gives you something to really think about, like just like the very nature of belief and how, is believing difficult? Like, because I feel like people who don't necessarily have faith can think of it as easy. Like, well, you obviously
think
don't.
From the outside.
Yeah. You obviously don't need any proof. So that must be super easy.
You are intellectually lazy because you don't need the proof that I need. So it's just easy to believe.
It makes sense that, like, he would assume that she thinks that, but she's trying to tell him that, like, it's not that I think that. I'm just like, you and I have two different pathways to the truth. Like, for you, believing is enough. Like, believing something is enough for you to think this is truth. And whether that's true or not, that's not the question. The question is, is it easy? And it very well may not be. I mean, in a way, finding, like, the evidence and finding the proof, if you have it available to you, that would be an easier route because you would have something that you can hang your hat on and say, this is the truth because I can see it and here's the proof.
Whereas it's very straightforward.
It's like, and I mean, again, it's like kind of like what Keith was saying on our interview with him several weeks back when we were talking about the idea of this show being about the search for God. You aren't going to find it. So all you have is your faith. That's all you have. And it's a constant battle. Like, it's a constant uphill struggle to believe because you're going to get that proof. And I feel like it's very interesting and thought-provoking conversation and coming from these two characters on this show, I just think is amazing. Probably my favorite scene in this episode.
I love it. It feels very Frank Spotnitz to me, I have to say. I have to kind of think that maybe he wrote that bit because, you know, he has such a great understanding of their two characters and how they mesh together. So that's kind of what I imagine happened, but I'm not totally sure. But it is it's such a key part of the X-Files about where Mulder and Scully are coming from in terms of those issues of belief and fact and what is enough for you to be convinced of something. And the whole idea in this case of like the grass is greener on the other side. Hey, I think it's easy to believe. Well, it's actually a lot easier if you're only concerned about facts. It's actually both of the paths they're on are difficult in their own ways. And it's interesting for us as viewers to watch them both walk this path mm-hmm. and the challenges that they each encounter in their own ways.
And having them walk it together and the Absolutely. Challenges that that presents, which
exactly is the exactly show. And how to respect someone who has such a different way of approaching things, but yet you still respect them as a person and can still work with them. And that's really interesting to me too.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Well, you know, the only thing I had left on Nisei was the actual name Nisei. You said you did research and you figured this out.
Good. I don't know if I figured it out, but apparently Nisei is a Japanese term for a child born to Japanese immigrants, Japanese parents who have left Japan and live in another country. If a child is born in that country outside of Japan, the child is considered the child of an Isei being a couple who is like an expat Japanese couple. And the child is considered a Nisei. So the child of a Japanese couple who was born outside of Japan is a Nisei.
Interesting. So I wonder if that is sort of in a roundabout way referring to the sort of MacGuffin hybrid, alien hybrid that they're chasing.
Yeah, that's kind of what I think, is that this is like sort of like the offspring of the work of the Japanese scientists. And that he was, this offspring was born in the States kind of thing.
I actually really like that. That's interesting. And
it's interesting.
I hadn't looked it up, and I was like, Jen, I hope you looked it up, because I didn't look it up. And I'm really glad you did.
It's the first time I actually looked that one up. And so it makes sense. It's interesting.
Love it. Love it. Well, I think we are going to wrap it up there. You guys can be back with us next time with the follow-up to this episode, which will obviously be 7:31. In the meantime, Let us know what you guys think about Nisei. What are your theories? Are you a believer? Are you a skeptic? No, I'm just kidding. Hit us up at XFD Podcast.
Yeah, no, but that's all interesting too.
I love it. I love talking about that stuff. At XFD Podcast on Twitter, and we will see you back again on X-Files Diaries.
Bye.